I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today I'm joined by Mike Cocking, a golf course architect based in Australia and part of the Ogilvy, Clayton, Cocking, and Mead design firm. Mike, welcome on.
Thanks, Andy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, excited to talk golf course architecture, some Sandbelt, Australia, and a little bit more about your firm and what you guys are doing down under.
Absolutely. Yep. Look forward to it.
So I'd love to hear, I think knowing you a little bit, I think you've got a really interesting background, how you got into golf course architecture. Why don't you tell us how you got into golf and architecture?
Sure. Well, I guess I got into golf, my first sort of experience with golf was my parents decided to take the game up when I was about, 7 or 8. And they dragged my sister and I out to the golf course and, you know, wander around with them. And we hated it. It was not interesting at all. Maybe I would have been hooked if I had been allowed to swing a club or try and have a hit. But they were just new to the game and probably nervous that I'd, you know, hit a shank and smash a car or something. So that was sort of my first taste of it. And then years later, my parents were teachers and they would start school a bit earlier than I would, so that they would drop me at my grandparents' house and I'd just, you know, watch TV for an hour before they would take me to school. And one morning, the golf was on and it was, I reckon it was the 88 US Open. So it was Curtis Strange and Faldo. And I found it quite, you know, captivating really, because it was a tight finish. I thought Faldo was cool because he looked like Harrison Ford and Indiana Jones was big at the time. So I was rooting for him. And I went to school and lo and behold, they tied. And so it was a playoff. So the next day I got to see it again. And that probably was what really grabbed me. And then I kind of found my parents' clubs in the cupboard at home and started kind of chipping around the backyard. And so my dad decided to take me to a driving range and it kind of went from there really. And he was keen to take up the game with me. So we sort of started together and I was probably 11 or 12. And, you know, went from the driving range to a, you know, a local kind of muni or, you know, public golf course. And then I sort of joined a proper golf course, if you like, when I was perhaps 13, 14. Then I joined Peninsula, where we're working now, when I was 17. I was there for about 20 years. And then six years ago, I joined Kingston Heath because I live literally next door to Kingston Heath, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, it's a good spot.
Yeah, so that was sort of my introduction to golf. To golf course design was a little bit later. I mean, I think, like most kids, I kind of drew golf. Once I was into golf, I was really into golf. You know, I would read all the magazines and, you know, see photos of Cypress Point and Augusta. And, you know, that was just like Disneyland to me. And I guess the thought of ever seeing those was certainly, you know, really held my attention. And then my boss at the time, I was working in a golf shop when I was about 15 or 16, and my boss got a copy of one of the limited edition copies of Tom Doak's Confidential Guide. And I borrowed that and sort of reading through that started to understand that there was this whole other element to golf courses that I'd never really thought about. You know, I guess like most kids, you sort of the condition of the course is probably what, how you measure whether it's good or bad. And suddenly he was, you know, talking about routings and talking about all these things that I didn't really know what they were. And then as my golf improved, I was in what's known as the Victorian Institute of Sport, which was it was kind of Australia's answer to the college program in America. So it was started in the 90s. Robert Allenby, Stuart Appleby, Jeff Ogilvy, Aaron Baddeley, they all came through that program. And through that, I got to travel. I was a good amateur, so I played sort of internationally a fair bit. And I used Tom's book really to find all the courses near where I was playing that are worth seeing. So that it kind of extended from there. And then I was never really comfortable with the idea of playing professionally. I did briefly, but I don't know. Maybe having options isn't a good thing if you're trying to be a professional golfer. But I'd finished a degree in engineering, and I didn't want to be a struggling pro by any stretch. And I was interested in golf course design, obviously, but figured it would be really hard to get into. But then Mike Clayton and a couple of other guys who had started a company together got the job at Peninsula to do some work, which was where I was playing. And I knew Mike through golf, and sort of approached them whether they needed sort of some help or part-time work, or whether, you know, whether I could, how I could kind of get involved in golf course design. And that was in 2000. So, and Ashley Mead actually joined that firm at the same time to help out with construction. So Mike, Ashley and I have worked together for 18 years, and it kind of went from there really. And then over time, I got more interested in golf course design, less interested in playing, and it just sort of, you know, I played less golf and worked more in design. So it kind of was a pretty, that's how it progressed, I guess.
Have you found that since you stopped caring as much about golf that your golf has gotten better the more you think about design when you play?
I enjoy it more, certainly. I having a bad round and not worrying about, not having to stress over all these putts you've missed or this shot you've missed and having to go to the range, work on it. You know, I enjoy my golf again, where you just, you know, you just have a round, and once you putt out on 18, that's the end of it. I always find it hard to look at, to kind of look at the architecture and play it at the same time, because you do get involved with your game, and I find I see a lot more just walking a golf course rather than playing it. So I'm never that fussed if I go overseas somewhere and see a golf course that I've always wanted to see. I'm not that fussed if I don't play it. You know, in an ideal world, you'd perhaps walk it in the morning and then play it in the afternoon, but really, do you have that amount of time free? So, yeah, I see a lot more kind of walking the golf course, I find.
Yeah, I would agree. You can just, it removes one, like, personal element from it, and, like, you're not looking for balls, and especially if you're walking it alone, you can just walk and observe it. You know, you're not talking to somebody. But it's rare that you get to do both.
That's right. And you probably don't concentrate on the, you don't notice the peripheral things, you know, because you do kind of just focus on the playing areas and down the middle or and wherever you hit your ball to.
What would you say is one thing that, like, the average golfer beginning to get into architecture do to understand more about architecture while they're playing?
That's a good question. I guess this, like on the sandbelt here, the strategies are fairly straightforward and quite, it's almost strategic design 101. You know, the greens are very clearly angled one way or the other. You know, and so if you study the green complex and work your way back, the strategy of the hole makes sense. And I think once they understand, like we talk about it a lot when we have like a committee meeting or something, it's amazing how few people understand the very basics of strategy, you know, and it's not really a complicated topic, but I think once they understand that, okay, well, you know, the green's designed to favor play from a particular part of the fairway, and usually around that spot there's a hazard, you know, so if you play close to the hazard, you get a better angle. And if you play further away from it, it's a worse angle. And it's, you know, there's shades of grey. It's not black or white. You can aim a meter a little bit to the right or 40 meters to the right, and the shot just incrementally gets harder. And I think once you can see the light bulb go off when you do explain that, and then suddenly they start thinking about all the holes on the golf course and how they're arranged. So I think it's, in terms of playing it, I think they need to understand that basic logic, and then they can kind of apply it to their own game and their own golf course. I tell you one thing that I find interesting. I've got a set of hickory clubs, I've got a couple of sets, but it's a lot of fun using hickories and on a strategic golf course, because you really understand the strategy of the holes. They make more sense because you can't hit, you know, with the hickories, everything comes out a bit lower and it runs. You can't hit that high spinning 9-iron that stops on the green if you're out of position. So the strategy of the golf course really shines through with hickories, if that makes sense. You have to be, it's such a reward for being in the right position and such a penalty for being out of position with hickories, just because you can't hit that recovery shot. So I think people would understand strategy very quickly if they had a round with hickories.
Maybe that's what people need to start learning golf on, hickories.
Maybe.
I don't think that's going to happen.
I think you'd have a hard time convincing a 19-year-old to put away his M2 and pick up a, you know, wooden shafted club. But
yeah, it might actually slow down the growth of the game.
That's right.
In terms of you guys have you got to have one of the best playing firms in the country between.
Yeah.
But working with Mike Clayton, Jeff Ogilvy, and Ashley Mead, how do you guys work and split up work?
There's a couple of other staff members as well that have worked with us for a long time. So we like that kind of turnkey approach, I guess. I've always liked the idea that we can do everything from the first kind of little concept sketch, basically right through. So like a lot of the modern firms like Bill and Ben and Tom and what have you, we build our own work. We don't really like to give it to a contractor. So I guess in the early phases of a new project or a design, we all kind of get involved with that and sort of chat through some of the big picture ideas. Jeff's still playing, of course, in America, so he's probably not as involved as, you know, as long term he hopes to be. As it moves into more of a construction, probably Ashley and I have more of a lead role in terms of being on site and working with the guys out in the field. And, you know, that can limit how many projects you take on. Usually two sort of big projects in construction is about as much as we want to do, because invariably you've also then got, you know, jobs that you're pitching on, or there might be two or three other jobs that are in design. And, you know, it's obviously more than just those two that are in construction. So, that's typically how it works.
In terms of, you got the collaborative approach, and obviously with Jeff and Mike, you've got a couple of big names from in Australia and obviously Jeff across the world. What are the benefits of working in that environment versus, say, being out on your own?
I think collaborative approaches, I do find it minimizes your misses. You know, sometimes if you're on your own, you go down a certain path and perhaps you're pushing hard to build a green or build a hole on the edge. It's helpful to have someone with fresh eyes come out and say, "Ooh, you know, I think there might be a bit of a stretch, or it's a little bit too hard, or a bit too slopey, or, you know," because you get so engrossed in that project that sometimes you forget to step back and look at the big picture. So that's where it's very helpful having any of the guys come in and really with fresh eyes have a look at it. Jeff and Mike, certainly from a playing point of view, is really helpful as well. I know there's been a, I mean, you don't build too many tournament golf courses. There's not many tournaments in Australia, but we do consult to a lot of courses that host tournaments. And it is sometimes interesting. You sort of forget how good those guys are, how far they hit it, what they see as being a reasonable shot to take on under certain conditions. So and it sometimes just kind of puts a different perspective on a hole. So that's always interesting. Versus on your own, I mean, perhaps maybe the negative of a collaborative approach is that you may not get those way out ideas because they might always be tempered by in a collaboration. But I think if you come up with an idea and put a case forward to why it's a good idea, typically we'll go ahead and build it and then you know, just see how it evolves. You can always, I mean, by building your own work, that's the advantage. You can build something. If it doesn't look right, you can just change it.
Yeah, that's I think sometimes I would benefit from somebody reading over some stuff that I write, because sometimes I might go a little far, you know.
Yeah, yeah. it's like the email, you know. I never send an email at night, you know. Yeah, because you can get it's amazing in the morning when you wake up and have a read of that same email. You're like, oh yeah, I'm not sure I can send that.
I send all my emails at late at night, so that might be one of my problems.
Wait for the morning.
So you're finishing up a project, Lanhai International in China. Yep. I'm curious how golf design and the golf culture is different there compared to Australia or the States.
Yeah, it's someone once described it to me as that, you know, golf in China and perhaps some other, not just China, but in the countries where golf is new, that it's sort of an unsophisticated market. And it's not a criticism, it's just that because golf is so new, they don't necessarily know what's good and bad, you know, what's good design, what's bad design. You know, in America, you know, you've had 100 years for it to evolve and to educate people, and longer in the UK, about, you know, 100 years in Australia. So it is tricky trying to, you know, so things like I guess most clients in China would expect a par 72, for instance, because that's kind of what they understand as being the norm, and you know, four par threes and four par fives and sort of all those things, just when you're new to golf design, that the things that you kind of understand as being the norm, that's sort of, I guess, where a lot of the golf is at. So that can be a challenge for sure. I know when Bill and Ben were building Shenkwin Bay, supposedly that it was so different, I think people were wondering just how the Chinese would react to it, because it was a course that you would expect to see, you know, in America, but perhaps not in a country where most of the golf courses were your typical resort style golf, you know, lots of water, sort of resort style bunkers. And they were wondering how they would react to it. But I believe the client there was very worldly. It traveled extensively around the world, so he kind of was confident that was the right approach.
Yeah, in China, they, unlike like the UK, they started with St. Andrews. America, we had like Chicago Golf and Newport Country Club. Australia, you had Alistair McKenzie pay an early visit and kind of set Melbourne on the right path. But in China, they got like Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer designing courses. Mm-hmm. And like the era of signature design gave, you know, birth to golf there.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. And now it's an interesting, because of the moratorium on new golf courses, there's, I believe there's 496 legal golf courses now in China, you know, because they've closed so many that were built illegally. And that hasn't really been opened up yet. So depending on how long that goes, because the course we're working on there was an existing golf course, and we've just, it's a redesign. So it may be that the next wave in China is more redesign work. It could be that where a lot of those golf courses, they're legal, but perhaps they're not as good as they could be, or they were part of, like you said, that sort of wave of signature designs, that it might spread now. The idea of redesign work might kind of start spreading into China.
So a high-profile club that you guys consult at is Kingston Heath, which is one of the best golf courses in the world. Regularly kind of comparison is the Australian Marion. And then you also consult at Shady Oaks, a high-profile course in Dallas. What are the similarities and differences between clubs in Australia and America?
So I guess Shady Oaks, so it's a really pretty parkland style golf course. Robert Trent Jones Sr. built it for Marvin Leonard in the 50s on the back of Colonial. So they built Colonial and they wanted a smaller private members course. Went to Shady Oaks, and of course Ben Hogan came across as part of that as well. So that became his home. One of the things that I always find fascinating, and hopefully this answers your question in a roundabout way, whenever we've looked at courses in America, it's not all courses, but a lot of the classic American parkland style course, we're always intrigued by the way they're set up, with typically, lots of rough around the greens, quite often rough between the fairway bunkers and the fairways, which we find curious, because in Australia, the norm is to cut fairways right to the edge of hazards. And we typically have a lot of short grass around greens. And so I think it's more of a British maintenance style in Australia. So we're really wedged firmly between, we borrow a little bit from Britain and a little bit from America, I think, with our golf. They certainly play firm and fast like they do in Britain, but there's other elements that are kind of similar to America. And what I guess is always interesting, and part of the pitch to Shady Oaks, or one of the things we sort of talked about, was that it's kind of interesting that Augusta, has been, if you ask most tour players what their favorite course is of the year, most of them would probably say Augusta. Most golfers in America, if you ask their, their dream round or where would they love to go, they'd probably say Augusta. And Augusta, it's essentially maintained like a sandbelt golf course. It's heaps of short grass around the green, short grass to the edge of the bunkers. It's kind of like Royal Melbourne, really. It's very similar. And yet golf courses went in a totally different direction. They went in another direction. And yet every year, everyone goes back to Augusta and loves it. And for whatever reason, it kind of went down this other path. So, one of the things, not that we're trying to turn Shady Oaks into a sandbelt golf course, but certainly we talked a lot about that, trying to create more short grass and perhaps align a little closer to the way we like golf to be played. And they've really embraced that. I mean, in the first, Brent and I flagged some new fairway lines there, and I think they added 10 acres in, a month of short grass, and the members have really liked it. So that is always a curiosity to me, though, that just the position that Augusta holds in American golf, and yet people struggle to join the dots. They look at their golf course and see the rough, and you talk about short grass, and they look at you perhaps like you're mad, or what are you talking about? And yet, come April every year, it's there for everyone to see. So yeah, that is a curiosity.
Most people seem to focus on like the flower beds and the green nature of Augusta and take the two worst things to their golf course and make it soft and slow and plant some flowers. But curious, with extending fairway lines, it seems that one of the common pushbacks from a club would be, you're making this golf course easier. What is your response to that?
Well, and that's true. I mean, you need to look at the whole package. Because if the green complexes and the bunkering isn't great, then, widening, of course, will make it easier. So they kind of fit together. I mean, ideally, there's lots of space for people to hit to, but in actual fact, the the desired area of the fairway is quite small, you know. And I think part of that, which is often forgotten about, is the maintenance. I mean, when people talk about tour courses and the like, I mean, one of the reasons that many of the Sandbelt courses are still so relevant from a tournament perspective is how firm and fast the greens are. You know, because you can't, I mean, Kingston Heath's not particularly long in sort of US tour standards. It's probably 7,100 yards, maybe 7,200 yards. But, you know, it's not just a driver off every tee, because the greens are so well designed and firm that if you are out of position, you can't easily hit. Sometimes you can't even hit the green if you're in the wrong spot. So suddenly you're prepared to sacrifice some distance to hit a 3-iron or hit a 2-iron into the right position of the fairway. So, but if the greens were really soft, then suddenly it wouldn't be quite as strategic, because you could play to the greens from anywhere. And if you watered it down even further and just built some fairly flat greens and bought the bunkers further away from the putting surface, then it would be even, you know, less strategic again. So it's not just you can't just look at the widening of the fairways. It has to be looked at with the position of the bunkers and the green design too. So there at Shady, there were some spots where you could easily add short grass, particularly around the greens, because there was a lot of greens that were perched up and there were some nice sort of hollows and slopes away from them where you could add short grass and not make it easier. In some ways, you know, short grass around the greens, if there's a slope, adding short grass actually makes it harder, because a missed shot, just the ball just finishes further away from the putting surface instead of getting caught up in that little bit of rough, you know, between the green and the bunker.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think when the ball rolls, it's very scary for good players especially.
Yeah, and it puts puts doubt in a good player's mind, because you don't know what to hit. You know, if it's done well, so suddenly you've got five clubs in your head thinking, well, do I hit the kind of that 3-wood bump and run that, you know, that Tiger kind of did a fair bit of, or do you try and hit a lob wedge, or do you bounce it into the slope with like a 9-iron or a wedge, or do you putt it? But the great thing is, for a hacker, for a bad player, they can just pull a putter and they can at least kind of knock it up there and knock it on the green. They probably won't get up and down, but it's a really, that's where it's a clever hazard, because it's hard for the good player or confusing for the good player and kind of easy for the average player.
Yeah, I'm in agreement there. A high profile project you're working is Peninsula, which is the course you grew up playing in Melbourne.
Yep.
You know, is there some pressure with all the great courses around Melbourne designing a new course with all the historic courses?
There is. I mean, it's a great bit of land, almost the equal to Royal Melbourne, really. But it was a course that it never quite had reached its potential. So there'd been redesign work done there previously, and we'd done quite a lot of that. But it was done on a shoestring, and it was never a comprehensive sort of redevelopment. And I guess that they merged with a golf club called Kingswood. So now it's sort of Peninsula Kingswood is the new club. And that allowed them financially the opportunity to look at a much bigger redevelopment, which is what sort of we're 2/3 of the way through. And the challenge for them absolutely is, so when people come to Melbourne and want a taste of Sandbelt golf, they typically go to Royal Melbourne and Kingston Heath. If they have time, they might go to Metropolitan Victoria, and usually that's it. Then they go. They might go down to Tasmania to play Barnburle Dunes or King Island, and then they're gone. And as a result of that, or this has actually influenced that mindset, that there is a big gap between those four elite Sandbelt clubs and kind of everyone else on the Sandbelt. So their challenge and our challenge is to kind of turn four into five. You know, when people come to Melbourne, they want to go to Peninsula Kingswood. So that, yeah, there is a lot of pressure attached to that. I mean, we've assembled a really good team down there, and so far the results are showing that, you know, it's looking really promising. But it's a hard nut to crack, that elite Sandbelt club, if you like, because they've had 100 years and copious tournaments that have kind of created their reputation. So it's hard to, we're trying to do 50 years work in three, you know, and that, so it's, even if we get the product there, it's still going to take a little time for, I think, for that to influence, you know, rankings and how people view the golf course, both here and overseas.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the American top 10 golf courses, there's only one modern golf course in there, Sandhills. And, you know, at this point, it's now 25 years old almost.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So it's tricky because the history and the tradition always get lumped into judging the golf course. Are you guys pulling a lot of influence from those area courses, and or are you trying to build something new and unique?
No, we're, one thing, it's a bit of a cross between, or a bit of a hybrid of some of the other Sandbelt courses. There's two courses there. So there's a north course and a south course. And we built many years ago a creek on the south course through sort of a low section of the course. And looking at old photos of the site, there were actually quite a lot of creeks that ran through the property. So there was quite a few wet areas. And so we had an idea to maybe make a better looking creek. We used a local stonemason to kind of create the impression that it was like an old ruin, I guess. So sort of it was interesting because clients typically judge how well he did a job by how perfect the rock work was, the dry stone wall. And we were like, no, we don't want it perfect. We want it rugged and old and sort of, you know, almost falling apart. So he really enjoyed it because it was totally different from what he was used to. And so we did that on one hole, and it worked out so well. We ended up creating that creek network through a number of holes. So in a way, that became a bit of a signature of the south course, whereas the north is a bit more elevated, it's a bit more undulating, it's sandier, and so it's probably more, and the vegetation's better, a lot more heath and kind of almost a monostand of the manukam, which is the kind of the tree which most would identify with a lot of the Sandbelt courses. So it's probably more of a typical Sandbelt experience. And whilst the south is a Sandbelt course, it's just that the creek kind of creates a little bit of a point of difference between the north. In terms of the greens and the bunkers, though, they probably weren't. One of the big drivers of the project was conditioning. They've never really had firm, fast greens, which are kind of, you know, synonymous, I guess, with Sandbelt golf. So a lot of work, we basically created a new sort of a different style of construction with the greens. So there's been a lot of USGA greens on the Sandbelt built over the last 30 years, but people have struggled. They really struggle to get them firm. So we went with a different construction technique, a different grass. And one of the things we'd noticed on the old greens was that the bunkers weren't, they were very much out of scale with the greens. If you look at Sandbelt holes from the air, the bunkering around the green is bigger than the green. So it really, that's what helps create the scale of the green sites on the Sandbelt. I mean, people look at Royal Melbourne's greens and think they're enormous. And they are big, but they're not that big. The reason they feel big is because it's so expansive around the green. The bunkering's really expansive and a lot of short grass. So they're these big, they feel like these huge, elegant green sites. So we very much borrowed from that concept with the green sites at Peninsula. We cleared out a lot of space around them. And the bunkering now is much bigger, much more of the sort of capes and bays that people, you know, people talk about, Mackenzie bunkering, but you know, it's probably a different topic. But so more of that kind of classic bunkering style that you would see at Royal Melbourne and Kingston Heath. More short grass. Yeah, and we've cleared out a fair bit of vegetation to try and return it to what we hope is what the property would have looked like, 100 years ago before there was a golf course there.
That's cool. Natural, much more natural, and
yeah.
Then you got the other side that's like got the rustic creek, So
absolutely. And it's sort of, I mean, they've given us, they've afforded us a lot of license, which has been, I mean, they've been just a fantastic club to work with. And so much, you just wouldn't get that license at many of the other Sandbelt clubs. You wouldn't be afforded that amount of license. But as a result, what will happen is that, you know, the North is the Sandbelt golf course that so many of the other Sandbelt clubs want to be. You know, so they really do have the potential to leapfrog a whole bunch of clubs and, you know, put themselves as a 36-hole venue. You know, they should be, it should be the place to join in Melbourne.
Yeah, and you get variety between the two courses. So it's so with you being down in Australia, I'm curious, I ask this question every once in a while, who's on your Mount Rushmore? So for architects, that's a Mount Rushmore, I don't know if you know, is a famous
I know Mount Rushmore. Well, it's hard to, we're so heavily influenced by Alistair McKenzie here. Rightly or wrongly, you know, but I think probably rightly, but, you know, he only spent 10 weeks here, McKenzie. You know, it's an interesting story. And so as a, you know, he came here, Royal Melbourne engaged him to come out, I guess through the RNA connection, to come out and design their course. I think he got paid £200. And to help pay for that fee, they sort of farmed him out to a lot of other golf courses, and they did a deal with him to split the fee. So for any other work that they could find for him, he would go halves on his consulting fee. And he was seriously active. I mean, he came here to Melbourne. He did the design for Royal Melbourne. He consulted to Kingston Heath next door and did a bunker plan. So, you know, at that time, it was quite common for courses to get built, and then they would do the bunkering scheme after they opened. So they would kind of see how people play the golf course and then figure out where to put the bunkers. So that wasn't uncommon at the time. So he did a bunkering scheme for Kingston Heath. He did a plan for Metropolitan. He did a bunkering plan for Victoria. He went to Adelaide and did a plan for a design plan for Royal Adelaide. He went to New South Wales. And went to New South Wales Golf Club, Royal Adelaide. He consulted at Bonnie Doon. He consulted at two or three others. He went to Queensland and consulted to, I think, Brisbane Golf Club, Indooroopilly Golf Club, all in 10 weeks. And he saw really nothing built. He saw the Fifth West at Royal Melbourne either built or partly built, which is that kind of famous, iconic par three from the elevated tee, elevated green, and you hit across the valley. And he supposedly saw or a little bit of 15 at Kingston Heath, the uphill par three, which was previously a, what could only have been an odd hole. It was a blind par four over the hill. So he brought the green back to the top of the hill. And I think he saw some bunkers built on the 13th at Royal Adelaide, and then he was gone. So, but he influenced, he struck up a relationship with Alex Russell, who became a designer in his own right and designed a pretty cool set of four golf courses. He did the Royal Melbourne East, he did Lake Cairn up in Perth, he did Yarra Yarra, and he did Paraparaumu in New Zealand, which are Great Links course. And he also taught a father and son team of construction guys. So Mick Morecambe, who was the Royal Melbourne superintendent, he built all his work there. And then he built the work at where they did a couple of greens at Metropolitan and did work at Victoria. And basically what you know as the Sandbelt look with bunkers is very heavily influenced by Mick Morecambe or his son Vern. And Vern became the superintendent at Kingston Heath, where he was for 46 years. And he changed that golf course a lot. He changed the bunkering a lot. He redid greens, he redid tees. So it's always interesting with McKenzie just how much people talk about the credit. The big unknown factor, like his primary influence was 10 weeks long. Maybe not that much, you know, did a couple of plans, but never saw them built. So he never really wrote about in his books how great the work was in Australia because he never saw it. Mm-hmm. But his secondary influence, I think, was huge. That's the thing. You know, he was clever that he found guys that were talented, I guess educated them, And then they then went on, and that then influenced the next generation and the next generation. So it was a defining moment. Those 10 weeks really changed the course of golf course design in Australia. So as an Australian, to get back to your question, he's clearly front and center in the Mount Rushmore of golf.
I think it would be crazy if somebody did a golf course the way they used to bunker it. If they waited until some people play it and then bunkered it, how much more effective and how fewer bunkers a golf course would have.
Yeah, the only tricky thing with it, I guess, would be the green complexes, because it's kind of hard to build bunkers and greens independently from one another. You know, they need to be built as one kind of shape. You're sculpting the land and you're building the green at the same time as you're building the shapes around the bunkers.
Might be a little bit more costly.
Yeah, that's right. But fairway bunkers, yeah, you know, I guess it's sort of, I mean, you would like to think now that I think
you should know.
It's good enough to think through it.
So you got Alistair McKenzie in your one spot.
Well, he's in there. I mean, I don't know. I've traveled quite a bit. I really like Colt in, obviously, in the UK and the influence he had over there. I really like Colt courses. I'm a bit of a sucker for, I haven't played a lot of his courses, but I'm always fascinated by Rayner and McDonald. And I would love to see, surely the time's right. Actually, in fact, I saw a photo of someone who was doing a bit of an ode to Rayner. You kind of wonder with golf course design whether art movements, whether we'll go through a different, you know, I mean, a lot of the new courses built now sort of look and feel similar. You know, it'd be kind of nice. I think it'd be cool for someone to build a super geometric, Rayner style, still strategic, but just visually quite different golf course. I would love to see that.
I think they're doing it at Arcadia Bluffs is one that looks similar. You know, it's got the squared off greens and the trench. It would be cool to see.
Bunker.
Yeah, it'd be cool to see one of those in Australia.
I would. I mean, unfortunately, I think because he's so unknown here that if you started down that track, the client probably wouldn't let you unless they were really well traveled. They would look at it and go, oh, you know, what are you doing? That would be the challenge to convince them that, you know, it's a worthy cause. I would probably have McKenzie, Colt,
we'll put McDonald. McRainer, you know, we'll make him one.
Yeah. And maybe just hanging off the edge. I think the Morecambes, I always feel a bit sorry for. I don't think they get the credit they deserve here in Australia anyway. Everyone talks about McKenzie, but when you look at Kingston Heath, it's a result of four or five different people over 100 years. It's not, you know, to call it a McKenzie course is way overstating it.
How do you, I mean, as an architect and knowing that a lot of work in this era will be redesigned, and usually there's only one architect on the scorecard, what's your thoughts on approaching, you know, should every architect be listed on a scorecard?
Well, the magazines, and they very rarely get it right. They either don't research it properly, or they credit the kind of the known person. I don't really see why. I would prefer that they didn't credit any architect, to be honest. I mean, it's the champion's the golf course and not the architects, you know, or trying to label one particular architect. So difficult. I mean, Kingston Heath, for instance, is, you know, it was a Dan Suter course. McKenzie did this plan. Mick Morecambe built some work there. Vern Morecambe was a superintendent. I mean, we're the consulting architect now, but it would be totally wrong to credit us to it. And then you've had all different captains and presidents over the years that have influenced it. Yeah, the golf course today is the best it's ever been in 100 years. And if you tried to restore it to any particular era, even the so-called McKenzie era, it would be a worse golf course. no way would it be as good as it is now. So it's kind of like, I don't know why. I mean, magazines are just obsessed by labeling each course with an architect. I would rather they didn't. Just call it, you know, Kingston Heath.
My uncle gave me this old Jeff Cornish, Ron Witten book. It's called The Golf Course. He found it in his basement and gave it to me. And it's so funny. It's got like all the golf courses in America and the architect, and like there are so many that are off. Like they've got Shore Acres in Chicago, which is a Seth Rainer listed as an Allison. Yeah. It's like, you know, how does somebody think that Rainer's work was Allison's? They're like completely different.
Yeah. So unless, and unfortunately, I mean, in reality, some court, not all courses, I mean, some new courses you could pretty confidently say who did it, but you know, some courses kind of read like the credits to a film, you know, I mean, it's you'd have to list 20 people and which clearly no one's going to do. So I don't know. I kind of get a bit over the whole trying to label every course to a particular person or people. I wouldn't bother myself to leave it off.
So a lot of my listeners are in America, and if you were going down, if you're an American going to Australia and you got 7 days, and it's probably the only time in your life you're going to go, what golf courses are you playing?
Well, it's, you really have to come to Melbourne, and I would, those four that I mentioned before, you would play the two courses at Royal Melbourne. Absolutely. You'd play Kingston Heath.
And we'll say a couple 36 hole days, not all 36 hole days.
Okay. So, well, Royal Melbourne you can do in a day. Let's call that a 36 hole day. So it's one day. Victoria, another. Metropolitan, another. Kingston Heath, another. So that's 4 days. I would then fly to Bumboogle Dunes. You've got to play Bumboogle Dunes and Lost Farm down there. Then on the day or two left, you could go to King Island. Selfishly, I would say you've got to come and play Peninsula Kingswood because it'll be finished by then.
Yeah.
But it's always a tricky one because people ask us that question, you know, would you go? But it's such a big country. And not that I'm, you know, there's not the depth of golf in the other major cities as there is in Melbourne. I mean, you could extend that if you wanted and play 10 courses on the Sandbelt. Whereas if you went to Sydney, you know, you might play New South Wales and perhaps the Lakes. Well, that's two. You know, if you went to Queensland, you're probably playing Royal Queensland and maybe one other. And Perth, there's really Lake Carinup. Adelaide, there's Royal Adelaide and maybe one or two others. So there's just not the depth. So to really get bang for your buck, I think you're better off staying in one place and doing it properly rather than trying to fly all around the country. So I think it's the No Lying Up guys pretty much did that trip. I think it was Melbourne, predominantly Melbourne, and then go down to Tasmania.
Yeah, it looked like an awesome trip.
We constantly hear... You know, it's on my bucket list. I'm not sure whether I'll ever get there. You've just got to suck it up and get on a plane. I mean, it's not that far. A couple of movies, a bit of a sleep, and you're here. So.
Yeah, one of my buddies is trying to get me to go next year or like this next holidays. So maybe. We'll see.
Maybe.
I got a lot of places to go. every podcast, I add another place to where I want to go. But what's like the, is there any like hidden gems that are worth seeing that nobody ever goes and sees?
There's a couple in New Zealand, definitely. Not many people see Parapara Umu. That's a really good links course. It's a fantastic golf course. And there's another course way on the southern tip of New Zealand, which is a links course. Let me think. I mean, there are some courses around that certainly to an American they would never have heard of that are worth seeing, but you just probably wouldn't do them in your 7 days because there's too much other good golf.
I gotcha. It's Tiggerangi any good? The Mackenzie down there in New Zealand?
Titirangi?
Yeah, Titirangi.
Yeah, apparently, so they restored, they did a lot of work there 10 years ago. Apparently, I haven't seen it since, but apparently very good.
Yeah.
You know, and then, of course, you've got the newer courses there as well, which are, you know, really good. So you could easily do a separate trip to New Zealand in 7 days.
It's not that far, too, right?
No, it's like flying to Perth from here. It's like a 3-hour flight.
Yeah.
From New Zealand, it's not very far at all.
You just need a month, really. You need a month.
Well,
everywhere.
That would be better. That would be better. I mean, it's a long way to come for 7 days. I will say that.
Yeah.
I mean, you're just getting over jet lag, and then you're going home again.
If you could
stretch it to 2 or 3 weeks, that would be better.
Yeah. So we'd be missing out if we didn't talk about your sketches, and I mean,
oh okay, yeah.
You're one of the world's forefront golf sketchers. How did
oh, I don't know about that.
Were you just always good at drawing?
Yeah, I was always interested in it. My dad was an artist, so he taught art at school. So he was an art teacher. So when I was young, I had a teacher right there at home. So, and I enjoyed sketching. So he would sort of show me basics, you know, perspective. And if I got, you know, if I was drawing something for a school project, he would sort of show me perhaps a better way of doing it. And so I kind of picked it up and put it down over the years, but never really seriously did it. And to be honest, it was only when I got into golf course design, there was a reason suddenly to draw, because it was very helpful. I think when I first started working in it, because no one else really could draw, it was an advantage to, if I had an idea for a hole, to be able to get a bit of paper and draw it on it in the field and say, what do you think of this? Suddenly it was something that everyone could see and everyone could understand. And it was a really good way of getting your point across. Whereas otherwise, you know, everyone's just, you know, pointing at various things, and you know, it's just confusing. So there was a reason to draw. And then, you know, if you're in a committee room, or sometimes I would draw for a plan, you know, to like do a worked up sort of drawing to do as part of a presentation. So I think that certainly got me interested in it again. And then when Barmbugle Dunes was built, Richard, the owner, wanted a course guide. He wanted a yardage book. And I'd done ones before when I was playing, just sort of little ones. But suddenly this needed to be like a commercially produced one. And I was pretty comfortable I could do it. And that was really the first one I did. And then out of that, just not really, I didn't really ever advertise, but just word of mouth, people asked me to do other course guides. And then I was quite keen to get to improve my proper painting, so not just course guide drawings, but actual landscapes and things. And so I just, over particularly the last 10 years, I've probably spent a bit more time doing it. And yeah, I mean, I don't have as much time to do it as I would like. It's only when people ask me to do a painting or commission me to do something, it tends to sort of maybe panic and think, okay, now I've really got to knuckle down. So that kind of forces me to really spend my spare time painting for a month until I can produce something that's really good. Mm-hmm. And then, but then it's not like I'm sitting at home each night just, with the paints out, sketching and the like. But
yeah, well, you got to have a life too.
I enjoy it.
Yeah.
What was that? Sorry?
You got to have a life too. You can't just do.
And because we've been so busy, it's just, yeah, I probably haven't spent as much time doing it. But just recently I did, a friend wanted some gifts for, he took a group over to America. And so I did 6 kind of proper watercolors for him, and they turned out really well. So that was good, because I basically painted for 2 months doing those in my spare time. And I definitely got improved at the end of it. I felt pretty good.
So I'm a horrendous drawer, sketcher, painter.
Yep.
What would be the most basic, easy piece of advice for somebody to get a little bit better?
I think you've got to understand perspective. I think really, If, so you mean like to draw a picture of a hole as it looks like if you're standing out on the golf course?
Yeah. Yeah. Like if I wanted to draw a hole, I'm horrible. Yep. I feel like I'm a 30 handicap asking for a tip on the range before a round right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's really getting a photo. If you just got a photo of a golf hole, of the green and the bunkers, and just kind of just forget all the detail, but just look at very simply where the flag sits, the green, and just the rough shape of the bunker and how perspective works. You know, it's things that are closer are bigger and, you know, further away are smaller. Just having an understanding of that would be very helpful.
That actually makes sense, because if I drew one, I would make them all the same size. You know, there wouldn't be any perspective.
And that's sort of, you see people, and they don't kind of fill the page. Like you see guys do a little sketch and it's this kind of little bird scrawl in the middle or whatever, or over on the edge. It's like, no, let's fill the page. Let's see, you know, make the green. Just sort of understanding the size of things, you know, how big a flag is, how big a green is, how big a person would be if it's standing on the green. Just kind of understanding the sizes and the scale and just how perspective works. You would go a long way to improving your drawing. You don't have to worry about, I mean, even if you can't, you don't have to be able to draw lifelike people or lifelike trees, but just a simple line drawing, just a kind of green and bunkers, it's so helpful. I mean, that's where it's helpful, I think, in design. It's just, you don't have to be brilliant at it, but it's very helpful to, like, if you're with someone on a machine and you want them to build something, that no one looks in plan view. No one sort of really understands if you draw something as though it's, because most plans are all from the air. It's very hard for people to understand how that translates to what's on the ground. Whereas if you can just do a really simple drawing in either in the dirt or on a bit of paper, suddenly it all makes sense. You know, how high a bunker lip's going to be, or the fact that, okay, you can see the left half of the green but not the right half of the green because it's covered by a bunker. Or the bunker comes a third of the way across the green, or, you know, those things in a very simple sketch. Suddenly it's, you can give someone enough detail to spend the day building something. It means you can go off and do something else. That's where it's really helpful.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's, if you're just telling somebody, they're going to take your words and interpret them in their head how they think that you want it.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we like to give the guys a lot of license to be creative. But yeah, if there's something that you really want, you know, we want to make sure it's this or that, you know, I'll do a little sketch and just sort of talk through it and leave it with them. Yeah.
So you ready for underrated, overrated?
Sure. Yep. Okay. Go for it.
What everybody's waiting for. All right. Sandbelt bunkering.
I would say it's underrated. In the world of golf, it's underrated.
All right. I think that's
fair. I mean, here we see it all the time, but the shaping and the way the short grass works into them, it's still, I think there's still so many clubs that could learn from sandbelt bunkering.
Yeah, just the mowing lines. Like, even if you got a little bit closer to that, it would be...
Yeah, you don't have to copy the sandbelt bunkers, but understand why they work well, I think, totally underrated. Yep.
Kangaroos as an animal, you know?
Underrated or overrated?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I don't know. Again, well... probably overrated for us. We see them. Yeah. Well, they're not. Yeah, we see them all the time, I guess. But I think the rest of the world probably wants to see more kangaroos.
I imagine that it's the easiest thing to spot, like a tourist, is seeing the way they react when they see a kangaroo, right? Because look at that.
I mean, if you think about it, they're a really odd creature, like very strange. You know, I mean, there's not really anything like them anywhere else in the world, I guess.
I hear they're mean.
You what, sorry?
I hear they're mean.
They can be. Yeah, they're big too, some of them. So there's a grey kangaroo and a red kangaroo. The red kangaroos, you see the greys down here in Sydney and Melbourne. The red ones are in the outback, and they are really, when they stand up on their back feet, they are tall, and their tail is so strong. You know, they can kill like a dog, like whipping the dog, and then they'll claw at them. Oh, so they can be mean. They're quite intimidating. When you see one standing up on its hind legs there. I've played golf tournaments before where, you know, you hit your ball near the kangaroos and you don't really want to go in there and get it. So they're pretty intimidating.
They're kind of like the Australian swan.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, swans are pretty, they can be.
I think they can break your arm with their neck. You know, this...
Oh, really?
Yeah, I like if they that. Snap oh, their right. neck, they can break a human arm.
Wow.
So, yeah, the course I grew up caddying at had the meanest swan in the world in one of their ponds. And like the thing, like you'd be walking like 20 yards away from the water edge and the thing would be hissing at you. It was, you know, and then one kid broke his arm from the swan. And that swan was gone. So,
disappeared.
Yeah, let's get back on subject here. Overrated, underrated golf in Japan.
I've never played there. I would say overrated. I reckon it's that. Wait a sec. Let me think about that. Because there's a couple of great courses there I've always wanted to see. But I think they're a long way from where they were by all accounts. I'm going to say overrated. Yep.
Maybe a place that's ripe for restoration of the. And I know that like Allison did a good.
Yeah, Allison did it. There. Yeah.
So.
There's certainly three or four that are, you know, by all accounts worth seeing, but they're just, you can, a bit like, you know, perhaps like LA Country Club was before the restoration, you know, you can kind of tell the bones of a great course are there, but it's just needs a bit of work to get back.
Is there anywhere like in Asia, like or Southeast Asia, that's like got sandy soil that the world hasn't found yet for golf?
Not sure about Southeast. I mean, well, actually, the world's found it, but the east coast of Vietnam, where there's quite a few courses being built, there's some really good sand dunes there all the way up. Greg Norman's group did a course there. Unbelievable sand dunes, huge. Ho Tram, it's called Ho Tram Links.
I heard of that.
Unbelievable site, beautiful site. So there are pockets. I mean, we used to think 20 or 30 years ago, you know, you would, didn't necessarily think of Asia as having all these great sites, but they do. You know, there's some really good land through Vietnam, China. There's some really good sites, so they're around, absolutely. And there's some really good sites in Australia. It's just that we don't have the population to, you know, the build it and they will come kind of concept it's hard here. You know, we just don't have the population base of America really.
Yeah.
To make it work. Yeah. But there's some Perth's very, there's some brilliant land in Perth, up and down the coast where you can drive an hour up north of Perth and it is incredible land on the water, sandy ground, undulating, beautiful vegetation. But they built a number of years ago, they built a really good golf course over there, only 40 minutes from Perth, and no one goes there to play. It's like you can't convince them to go.
That's crazy.
So you could build a sand valley. But just trying to get the people there would be the challenge.
I live in the city of Chicago. It's like a minimum of 40 minutes for me to golf anywhere. And if I could play golf on a coast on sandy ground, I'd be like 40 minutes done. So,
well, yeah. And that's the challenge for those courses on King Island. You know, the two that were built, they're spectacular, but you've either got to get on a little plane to get there, which is not everyone's kind of cup of tea. But, you know, and they're tiny. The island's got 1,500 people on it. So there's not enough people on the island to play there to just keep it, you know, ticking along. So it's just hard, you know, really hard for those isolated courses to get the traffic.
Yeah, I mean, that's almost everywhere, but... You know, they also don't have like the big American budgets that tell everybody that this is the greatest course ever before it's open.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Mike, thanks for coming on, and we'll look forward to seeing more of your work in the future. You're on Twitter, and what is it, at Mike Cocking?
Oh, my Twitter, yeah, yep, yep.
And then are you on Instagram too?
OCCM Golf on as well.
Yeah, OCCM Golf, at OCCM Golf, and then they're on Twitter. Lots of great pictures of golf courses that make you kind of drool.
Yeah, so fantastic.
Look forward to seeing some of your work in the near future.
Terrific. Thanks so much, Andy.
Thanks, Mike.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.